Hi, this is Bernie Wides, the naturalist. We're back on the air for another show on astronomy, and we'll call this Astronomy Part 2. Well, maybe we'll call it Part 4, because we did two shows in December, I think it was, and now we're back with 3 and 4. So 3 was finished. We start talking about stars, and my star here today, my guest star, is Michael Hamburg, who's a docent at the Museum of Natural History, where we both are, and he specializes in astronomy and the universe and the planets and the whole thing. So we started talking about stars on the last show, and we're going to continue a little bit. And Michael, I'm gonna ask you a question about the stars that we see at night in the heavens. If you live in the city, how many stars can you see if you live in the city at night?
Well, if you're lucky and have some view of the sky, you may see about a dozen or two stars, and they're the brightest stars, and usually they're the closest stars. If you go out to the country where it's a little darker, you might see a couple of thousand stars on a moonless night. Remember, right. The moonlight really washes a lot of the sky out.
Okay, so I know that you have your own observatory up in the Berkshires.
Yes.
So how many, did you ever estimate how many you can see from up there at night?
I haven't counted them, Bernie. I know that, you know, even though there is a historical precedent for somebody who did count them, but I think probably could see about 2,500 stars in the sky on a moonless night.
Okay, a nice clear moonless night.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think in the winter, the skies are clearer than the summer, aren't they? Because there's less humidity in
exactly,
it.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. It's much sharper because the air is drier.
It's drier, yeah. Right. Okay, so in winter, you'll have to go up there.
Except it's cold.
And put on all your clothes.
Exactly.
Because I know you have to open the roof up.
Absolutely. No heat.
No heat at all. Keep those instruments just right. Yeah. Okay, so we're going to continue talking about stars. We spoke about, did we talk about different kinds of stars? Let's, you know, we mentioned the lifespan of stars, and I know that there's some kind of a classification of stars at the planetarium. So maybe you want to touch on that for a minute.
Sure. First, when we look at the sky, most people see the stars as identical. They look like little white dots, and sometimes they twinkle if the air is moving. But upon real examination, stars are as different as individuals are among humanity. Mm-hmm. They come in different sizes. They come in different colors. They have different personalities, and they develop different kinds of irregularities, and finally they die different types of deaths.
Mm-hmm. I guess they have no insurance. That's it.
They have the insurance of the longevity of the universe, which is estimated to be good for about another 100 billion years.
That long for our universe?
Yes.
Okay, that's comforting to think about.
And the reason why stars are different is simply one fact, and that is how much material goes into the construction of that individual star. The more mass or stuff that a star has, the denser it will be. That means it will then have hotter nuclear fires. It will burn at higher temperatures, giving off higher forms, more energetic forms of electromagnetic radiation. The price for that, of course, is a shorter life span.
Okay, the hotter you are.
The hotter you are, the shorter you do.
The shorter you do. So listen to that, folks, you know, in our lives too.
Yes.
You don't want to burn out.
So stars are organized according to their temperature and their color into what's called spectral classes. And this work was done about 100 years ago by two astronomers working independently of each other, but simultaneously. One was a Danish astronomer called Einar Hertzsprung, and the other was an American called Henry Norris Russell. And the work is now known as the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, or the HR diagram, which is simply a correlation between a star's brightness or its energy level and its temperature and its color. The color and the temperature are usually along the same X axis.
Okay, so the color of the star tells us how hot it is.
Yes.
Okay, so the brightest stars are blue.
Well, this is interesting.
Blue-white color?
This is interesting, Bernie, because when we talk about brightness, we have to actually make an allowance for distance.
Okay.
Okay, and this was a tricky thing. So imagine having 200-watt light bulbs.
Right.
One of those light bulbs, you put 6 inches from your eye. The other, you go 100 yards down the street and you say, how can I compare the brightness of these two? And of course, the one down the street is going to look much dimmer. Mm. And that is a function of distance. So we had to, as astronomers, solve that and make believe we could take a stars and put them all at the same distance.
At the same distance,
measure
right.
their brightness. And that's something called absolute magnitude.
Okay, because in the night sky, you can't tell.
You can't tell.
When you look at the stars, they all look like they're the same distance. Except if you have a background in astronomy and you know the size of some of these stars. Like I know that Rigel, my favorite huge star, is in the knee of Orion, the Hunter. But when I look at Orion, all the stars look about the same.
Yeah.
So Rigel is pretty far from Earth.
Right. Rigel is almost about 900 light years from Earth. And if you put Rigel, which is a huge star, where the sun is, the planet Mercury would actually be circling inside the star.
Right. So Rigel is a huge star.
Huge star.
And it looks, you know, to my eyes, it looks as bright as most of those stars. There are stars that look dimmer, but it may be distance, as you say, or they may be a smaller star.
Right. Right. So that they have to differentiate between the appearance, the apparent brightness
right.
and the absolute, and astronomers do that. But again, normally the colors will tell you the temperature, where the white, blue-white stars are the hottest, and then you move down the spectrum towards the yellow stars, which are in the middle, towards the orange and red, the cooler. And most stars, Bernie, are actually red.
Mm-hmm.
And they're almost invisible because they are small. These are the so-called red dwarfs. They have just enough mass to initiate nuclear fusion. And the reason we didn't know about them for so long is because we didn't have the instruments to pick up their faint light.
Right. They didn't give out enough light for us
right.
to see.
But now we know the majority of stars are these red dwarfs. And as far as we know, they have never, none of them have ever died
mm-hmm.
because corollary to burning bright and a short life, if you are cooler, you have a very long life. So these red dwarfs, their lifespans are measured in trillions of years. And of course, the universe is less than a trillion years old.
Yeah. So stay cool, folks.
Stay cool.
Stay cool. Keep a cool head and maybe you'll live a longer time. So this HR diagram that you're talking about, it's still a little vague in people's minds, but if you come to the museum and to the planetarium, we have a terrific diagram of this on our base level floor when it talks about the stars. And also, if you go online today, you can find everything online. Just put in Hertzsprung, what's his name? Russell.
Yep, Russell. Henry Russell.
Hertzsprung Russell, HR diagram, and it'll show you this classification of stars by their luminosity?
Luminosity and their color.
And their color.
Which means
right.
temperature. In physics, color is simply temperature.
Yeah. So, you know, that leads us to this thing of energy and matter, because we deal with that in the stars, right? We're changing matter into energy by nuclear fusion. So you want to talk about that a minute,
sure.
Michael? I think we have 1 minute left in this segment.
Sure. Simply that, and I can't take credit for this knowledge because Albert Einstein already did it.
Really?
Al did it. So what we discovered is that one form can be translated into another. You can take matter, which is the more familiar to people, take a piece of coal and burn it, and you get energy. It's the same thing if you take matter and you fuse it in a nuclear way, you get tremendous amount of energy because it's releasing that strong energy that's keeping
that bond.
Bonds the atoms together
mm-hmm.
or repels them from each other.
Right.
The other thing is when some people then ask me, well, can I take energy and make matter from it? This is done usually in high energy particle accelerators, which mimic the beginning of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of energies are now being approached in the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland. And we should be getting some news from that in the next couple of years.
They had a little trouble with them.
Yeah, it's working now, though.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Okay, so we were talking about high energy, and our energy is still pretty high here. We're still doing well. We're going to sign off in a minute. But before that, I want you to know our sponsor today is Hearst Ranch, the purveyors of grass-fed beef. And this is The Naturalist on Heritage Radio Network. And my guest today is Mike Hamburg. And we'll be back in a minute to go back into the heavens. Hi, this is Bernie Wides, a naturalist, back on the air again. And before we get into our subject of stars, I want to remind everybody that now on the internet, on our shows are listed on the Heritage Radio Network, there's a place for comment. So it would be nice if we heard from some of you folks. I've got some nice comments last week on the shows. And if you have any questions or anything you'd like us to cover, well, just tell us about it, and we'll try to get to that topic. So we're back with Michael Hamburg, and we were talking about stars. And Michael, let me ask you, what happens to the stars when they die? Because they're different, they must have different kinds of deaths.
Exactly, Bernie. The stars, again, their fate is sealed as soon as they're born, and that the mass of that star determines what happens to the star for the rest of its life.
I mean, it's so, like having genes.
It's more than having genes, because it's actually like predestination.
Predestination.
Yeah,
okay.
At least we hope that we believe that we have some degree of free will and we can change things, but a star cannot do that. Mm. It is purely a slave to its physics. Mm-hmm. And what happens, let's say, again, to reassure people, the sun will never have a violent end. It just isn't big enough and it isn't energetic enough. It will slowly swell, turn red, and become a red giant. And eventually, the core of the sun will be exposed after the outer atmosphere is blown off. And what we have then is called a white dwarf. It is the exposed core of a sun-like star. And it's typically about maybe 200 to 500 miles in diameter. Mm-hmm. And is very, very bright, because it's still the nuclear fire in there. And if Earth was still here, you would have a dark sky, and the white dwarf would look like a brilliant flash in the sky. That eventually goes out, and then you have the cold, whatever cold matter is left.
Okay. So, what about other deaths of other stars besides our sun?
Okay, great. So, as we get more massive, then things really get interesting.
The bigger the star.
The bigger the star, the bigger the fall.
Right.
So, the more massive a star, let's say between maybe 4 and 10 times the mass of the sun, different things happen. Because it's more energetic, it has been fusing heavier and heavier elements together. Usually it comes up to iron. Mm. Iron has a strange property in that it absorbs energy rather than gives it off. So once iron forms in the core of a big star, that is the end of that star. The fire goes out, the core begins to collapse rather rapidly, and if it's dense enough, it will bounce off each other and become a huge, huge explosion that tears the star apart. We call that a supernova.
Supernova.
Right,
and
type one.
We've seen some supernovas.
The last one that we've seen was 1987 in the Small Magellanic Cloud, 1987A, and we actually looked at pictures and found the progenitor star on earlier photographs about it. It was a blue giant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it has to be a pretty big star to go supernova. That's why I always reassure people the sun will never explode.
Oh, the sun is just a medium-sized
star. It is a medium star.
You know, you mentioned this creating elements. So in the thermonuclear fusion, we have the creation of all of the elements, right?
Absolutely.
And those elements make up the periodic table.
All right, and I always like to remind people at the museum, and I show them, I say, I have a grocery list here of all the ingredients you need to make a universe. And when I take it out and show them, they usually laugh with some sign of recognition that this was something that bedeviled them in high school chemistry.
Right.
So the periodic table is, again, it's all of the basic building blocks that make up our universe.
Mm-hmm.
And the work on that began in the 18th century, doing that.
But we've added this stuff to it.
Oh, we've added. We've actually made our own artificial elements.
Right.
Yeah, but they're so heavy that they only last for a fraction of a fraction of a second.
Right.
So these elements are part of our bodies, too. So that's part of that recycling story we talked about.
Okay. Okay, so what? There's one here that I really don't know anything about, called the Wolf-Rayet stars.
Okay. Wolf-Rayet star is a massive star, a blue giant star that's giving off tremendous amount of high energy in the form of gamma rays. Gamma rays are the strongest, most energetic form of electromagnetic radiation. Think about it as light that could kill you.
Hmm.
All right. And they actually use gamma rays in surgery to operate on tumors that are inapproachable by knives. Mm. So that's a pretty powerful form of radiation. Yeah. And these Wolf Rayet stars are on their way to becoming supernovas.
Okay. And the one that fascinates most people are black holes.
Black holes, yes.
So that's the result of a dying star also.
What's interesting about black holes is that they're not black, right, and they're not holes.
Right.
So a black hole is the remnant of a collapsed star, and it becomes so dense that its gravity prevents any radiation from leaving it, including light. Okay. So whatever falls into a black hole is there pretty much for the life of that black hole.
Therefore, it's called a black hole.
Black hole, because
no,
we can't see it.
Yeah. Right. Do we have one at the center of our solar system?
Well, there are different types. There are two confirmed types of black holes.
Okay.
There's the stellar black hole, which is the result of the collapse of
a
massive star.
Yeah.
And then there are galactic black holes, which is a huge, huge body of mass at the center of galaxies that seem to have something to do with the creation of galaxies and keeping its structure.
Okay, it provides the mass for the gravitational attraction.
It's like the hub of a wheel.
Yeah. Keep all that other stuff spinning in place.
Right.
Okay, and what about the blazars?
All right, blazars. These are all variations on a black hole. Now, blazar is a black hole that is spinning rapidly, and what's happening in that is that it's giving off these jets. You can see pictures of
the jets,
black holes,
right,
with bipolar jets, and that's not a disorder. It's it's really these high-energy particles that come out for light years in length, and if one of them is facing the Earth, and as it's spinning, we get that. This is called a blazar. They are part of the evolution of a star in what's called high-energy physics now.
Okay.
It's a whole specialty.
Yes. I don't think we'll go into that. That's too high energy for me. Yeah. So we're talking about the death of stars.
Mm-hmm.
And because the stars are different sizes and they have different masses, they die in different ways.
There's an interesting story about the other one here called pulsars, which
pulsars.
When a star blows up as a supernova, if there's a remnant left, it's a very, very small, dense body called a neutron star.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that its matter is made up of atoms, just that have neutrons, and
just
all packed together. And they turn very rapidly. It has to do with picturing an ice skater in this angular momentum. They're turning, and as you shrink in diameter, you spin
up. Right.
So most of these stars, these neutron stars, are spinning very rapidly. Back in the 60s, they were not known until a young graduate student and her mentor found a signal that was flashing every so often.
Mm.
And the first thought, of course, was alien civilization. And we're finally getting a signal.
Yeah.
In fact, the study was first called LGM, because little green men. They searched the sky and they found three more. That gave them the clue that it had to be a natural phenomenon, because what are the odds of four alien civilizations trying to signal the Earth at the same time?
Yeah, with the
but it was still known as LGM.
With the same flashlights.
Exactly. So what they found was something that they named pulsar, which is a rapidly spinning neutron star. Remember, it's a very tiny object, only maybe 20 miles in diameter, but dense so that one teaspoon of a neutron star would weigh millions and millions of tons. Everything is squeezed together. And this neutron star was flashing a beam of energy at the Earth in that pulse. And that's what they were picking up, and hence the name pulsar.
Okay.
And we know we've discovered hundreds of them now.
Yes, and they are remnants of a star.
Exactly.
Okay, but then they still have enough energy to do this pulsing.
They do,
that, right?
They do.
Yeah. Okay, so we have to stop for a second here, and we just spoke about the death of stars. Different size stars have different deaths because of their mass and their temperature. And we'll continue the next part of the show when we come back. And our sponsor is Hearst Ranch, grass-fed beef, and I think they're out in California. We'll be right back. Hi, this is Bernie Wides, the Naturalist, with our last segment of this show, which has been about stars and other matters celestial, with one of my favorite guests, Mike Hamburg, who's an amateur astronomer and a docent at the Museum of Natural History, and is very knowledgeable about this subject. So, Michael, we stopped when we were talking about the death of stars, and we mentioned the pulsars and neutron stars and black holes and quasars and all those different ways that stars die. But some of them, when they die, they give off a tremendous amount of energy also. So there's one more term that I think we should discuss that we've heard about, a wormhole. Now, I used to do a lot of fishing. I used to look for wormholes in the ground.
We could find them in apples.
Yeah, right. So why don't you talk about wormholes, and then maybe we'll shift into something a little more, something else anyhow.
Well, wormholes, it's a good segue, Bernie, because they're pretty exotic. And right now, a wormhole is a speculation, not a fact. And the wormhole, if you have a black hole with this intense gravitational field around it, it actually bends space in a very, very severe way. I mean, this is all part of Einstein's general theory of relativity about gravity, and gravity is the bending of space by an object. So in a wormhole is a black hole. We don't know what happens inside a black hole.
Right.
There's a lot of speculation. And one of the thoughts is, if a black hole is a hole in our universe, does it come out someplace else?
That's right. We don't know.
We don't know. I mean, picture a piece of paper.
This is still theoretical, pretty much?
Well, we know that a black hole bends space severely.
We know that.
But we don't know what happens inside.
Inside the black hole.
We don't know.
Right.
We don't know if it leads anyplace. But theoretically, if you can picture a sheet of paper, and I'm in one corner, and I want to get to the other corner, I can travel across the diagonal of that paper.
Right.
That takes a long time. But if I can fold the paper so that the two corners are next to each other, then the short trip here. And that is the idea behind a wormhole, this wormhole is a shortcut through space.
Okay, so you're bending space.
Bending space.
Like Einstein said, objects bend space.
And it's a tunnel.
That's at a tunnel.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is getting pretty exotic and all that.
Yeah.
But if you come to the planetarium, in the museum, or any planetarium, it's a little bit more understandable if you see a model of it, or a diagram, or a film. And we have a little film at the museum that's been going for 10 years about black holes, which is terrific, because it really shows bending of space and Einstein's relativity and all that. So, we keep plugging our museum because it's a great museum. Of course, it's the best one in the city to see this. Other cities have great museums too, and planetariums. Okay, so we spoke about a lot of these exotic things, and we spoke about recycling, and we talked about energy and matter. And Michael, is there something else you wanted to add to this before we move on?
Yes. Well, one of the most surprising things is that when we look around the universe and take all our stars, and stars, they reside in these huge families called galaxies. And a typical galaxy has anywhere between 2 and 400 billion stars in it. Our own galaxy is the Milky Way.
Yes.
And on a good clear night someplace, you can see this arch of stars forming a bright band. And we're actually looking from our neighborhood across into another arm of the Milky Way and seeing millions of stars.
Yeah. I think we should emphasize that everything we see in the night sky with the naked eye is in our galaxy.
Yes. Yes.
Right?
Except you can't see the Andromeda Galaxy
if you have good eyes.
Yes.
Okay? And if you're in the southern hemisphere, you can see the Magellanic clouds, which is
Are satellite galaxies getting closer and closer.
They're getting closer.
Because our galaxy is sweeping up all of the things that are orbiting it, including the Magellanic clouds.
That's because of our gravity.
Which leads me to this one thing.
Go ahead.
Everything in our neighborhood is being merged in the in our Milky Way galaxy, but on a large scale, things are getting farther and farther apart in the universe. And that was, somewhat expected with the Big Bang blowing everything apart, but thought was that eventually that would slow down, and if there was enough gravity, that would reverse that and things would start getting smaller. The case is that about 10 years ago, the opposite was found to be true, that the universe is expanding at an accelerated rate. what is this? What's pushing everything apart? And we call this, for want of a better term, dark energy, some kind of anti-gravity. It's still very mysterious, and it's, the verdict is not completely in on it. What is interesting is when you look at all those billions of stars, that is a mere fraction of the matter-energy equation that makes up our universe. It makes up maybe about 5% of everything that makes up our universe. Most of our universe is unknown.
Right. We don't know that much about it.
We don't know. Picture yourself in a rowboat on a lake, giant lake, and you can't see the land, but you don't know what water is.
Yeah.
That's a very odd feeling.
So when we, there's still a lot to learn and explore, because I know at the museum we use the expression the observable universe, which tells us that we can't really see back to the beginning of the universe, or the edge of the universe, if there is an edge.
Well, what's interesting, so Bernie, is that we see because starlight is coming back to us. And the further out we see, we're actually looking back in time, because the speed of light is finite, basically about 6 trillion miles every year. That's a light year. And past that, we don't know. We don't know. Right. The universe is probably bigger. Maybe it's even infinite.
Right.
You know, more so than our knowledge of it. So we don't know, and we do speak about the observable universe, and that's everything that we get some signal back from.
Right, so there's a lot to learn yet. I mean, we have these great instruments, but still they're primitive, because we really, really can't see a great deal that's out there. And as you say, dark energy and dark matter, they're called dark because they're mysteries yet.
Yeah, well, dark matter is a very interesting thing, because it actually doesn't give off any observable radiation.
Okay,
but we know it's there. The only thing that we do, why we know it's there, is that it has gravity. Remember I said that all mass has gravity in the universe, and dark matter, we don't see it, but we feel the effects of its gravity. It actually keeps galaxies in shape and makes them turn faster than they should if there wasn't dark matter.
Yes, if there wasn't, well, the things that we can observe don't make up enough matter to keep our universe together.
Correct.
It would just dissipate out into space.
Correct.
So there's something that's keeping our universe as a universe.
Right. Well, it's interesting, because on a local level, that's true. But on a vast cosmological level, the universe is actually pulling itself apart.
It is pulling, everything is separate, going off in different directions.
Right. So you better get
a tough concept.
Yeah, get all your observing done now, because somewheres in the future, you won't be able to see anything out there. Everything will be too far away.
Michael, are you sure you want to buy that new telescope for yourself?
I want to get it quickly, because things are getting further and further away.
Yeah,
that's
just
true.
Another thing about observing is, you know, when we look in our skies at night, we see the planets also, and they are glowing like stars. But we know that they're not stars, because they're not burning, they're not giving off any energy. So keep that in mind, folks, when you look up at the heavens, that some of the bright objects that you see are really reflected light from the sun.
Absolutely. The moon, of course, is the most famous one,
right?
And the planets right now in the sky, we're saying goodbye to Mars, which was burning very brightly as an orange color. But again, that is reflected light off its surface. And Saturn, the most majestic planet, in my opinion, is coming into prominence for the next few months.
Okay, so what does prominence mean?
Prominence means that it will be one of the brighter objects in the sky.
Okay, which part of the sky should we look for?
I would say around, everything rises in the east, transits the top of the sky called the zenith, and sets in the west. So again, it's the time of the night, usually around 10, 11 o'clock. Right now, Saturn will be above enough of the buildings in the city or the trees in the country to see it. And in a month or two, it will rise earlier, and so you don't have to stay up all night to see it.
Yeah, I think we should emphasize the point that when things rise and set, it's really the Earth turning around on its axis, because we are the ones that are doing the moving. We are rotating on our axis, and we are revolving around the sun. So all that apparent motion of the heavenly bodies is just, I would say, an illusion.
Well, some of it is and some of it isn't, Bernie.
Okay.
That definitely day and night is turning of the Earth on its axis, but we are actually also going around the sun. So the night sky is different. That's why we'll see certain constellations at certain times of the year. Also, the solar system is traveling around the galaxy, around the center of the galaxy, and it takes about 250 million years for our solar system to make one circuit around the Milky Way galaxy.
Around the Milky Way galaxy, right.
The galaxy in itself is all rushing towards something they call the Great Attractor, which is a huge cluster of galaxies. And the universe in itself is expanding, and things are getting further apart from each other. So there's a lot of movement. Luckily, we're not aware of all of it. Otherwise, we'd be perpetually nauseous.
Right. So, but for our local observations, it's the rotation of the sun and the movement of the sun around, excuse me, the rotation of the Earth and the movement of the Earth around the sun
right.
in the sky.
Right.
The zenith, which is at the top of the sky, everything rises up from the east and sets in the west. And yesterday was the vernal equinox. So the equinox, it means equal. So it's the equal amount of day and night. And as we move further into spring and summer, the days get longer. And that has to do with that tilt of the axis right. that we spoke about, I think, last time.
Yes. And what's interesting about that is that in the summer, we are actually further from the sun than we are in the winter.
Right.
And that is really surprising to a lot of people.
It is. Everybody pictures that we're closer to the sun in the summer. That's why it's so high. But it's really the angle of the energy coming to the Earth. Okay? So all these concepts are kind of difficult. But if you go online and go to some of the websites about astronomy, what's one of the best ones, Mike? We have a couple of seconds.
Exactly. Up. I mean, skyandtelescope.com, astronomy.com, space.com. All of those are wonderful websites.
Okay. And with that, we're going to sign off. Our sponsor was Hearst Ranch. And my guest today was Michael Hamburg, who I always enjoy talking to. And I hope that you have also.